Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say that we're talking to Dan Sidorek about his new book, Condensed Capitalism, Campbell Soup and the Pursuit of Cheap Production in the 20th Century. One time in college I had a summer job in an aircraft factory, and in that aircraft factory I counted screws. I kid you not, that was my job. I counted screws. They had divided up production in every imaginable way so that every job had a discrete task, and mine was counting screws. I have to tell you, it was not a very interesting job. And one of the things that it taught me is that I did not want to pursue a career as a screw counter. No knock on anybody who actually still counts screws. I think it's important to realize, though, that there are a lot of people that do this sort of work in factories where a lot of what is called de-skilling is going on, and Dan Sidorek has told the story of one industry in which de-skilling took place in a kind of radical way. You've probably made soup. Well, Campbell Soup designed a way to create millions, probably billions of gallons of soup by now through the factory production of soup. And it's an interesting story. It's one of innovation. It's one of the growth and proper application of capital. It's one of satisfying people's needs for cheap and expensive and nutritious food. But it's also the story of the struggle between management and labor. And a little bit later, it's the story of a corporation that faced intense competition from overseas and some price pressure at home and decided eventually to move out of its home. And that home, in Campbell Soup's case, was Camden, New Jersey. They took their production facilities out of Camden in the 1980s. We should thank Dan for telling the entire story from the very beginning of Campbell Soup, well over 100 years ago, to the moment at which they left Camden and even up through today. So in any event, I enjoyed talking to Dan today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm very well. And you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. I just had a big breakfast, actually. Today we're talking with Dan Sidorek about his new book, Condensed Capitalism, Campbell Soup and the Pursuit of Cheap Production in the 20th Century. This is an excellent book. It's kind of a history of capitalism from the inside out. That's the way I think about it. At least it kind of takes you into the Campbell Soup factory in southern New Jersey, in Camden, New Jersey. I bet you didn't know that Campbell Soup used to be made there. And he explains over this quite a long period, over 100 years, exactly how it was that the people that owned and operated Campbell Soup and the people that ran the factory interacted and what they produced and how this weaves in and out of the more general story of the development of, as he well puts it, cheap production. Things are astoundingly cheap. Cheap production in the United States. And it's really a fascinating read. And if you're interested in economics or economic history or social history or labor history, this is a terrific book. And, of course, it's particularly relevant now that we have labor issues on the front burner practically daily in the news. And I'm thinking of the Wisconsin. But not only the Wisconsin, here in Iowa, too, we have issues that involve unions. So Dan's book is very relevant at this particular moment. So, Dan, thanks for being on the show. Let me ask you to begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself.
Okay. Well, I was born in Philadelphia and raised in Philadelphia and the Philadelphia suburbs. I came to the study of history in a rather roundabout way. I got my bachelor's degree actually in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. I later got a master's degree in mathematics and worked in a number of different jobs over the years. Eventually, I began to systematize my study of history. I'd always loved history, but had studied it in a fairly unorganized way. I began taking graduate courses at Temple University and decided to apply for the PhD program there. Over the ensuing years, I received a PhD from Temple with a focus on American social and economic history in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. And, you're actually the second mathematician that we've had on this show. Mathematician become historian. So you're not alone.
That's interesting.
Yeah, you're not alone. There are two of you.
I didn't realize that.
And as many of the listeners to this show will know, my wife is a mathematician. They're sick of hearing that. They've told me, but I'm sorry about that, listeners. So tell us a little bit about how you came to write Condensed Capitalism. Was this your dissertation? Is that right? Or
It came out of my dissertation.
Yeah, so,
it's revised from my dissertation.
Right. So why don't you talk about the process by which you came to the topic as a dissertation and then transformed the dissertation into this wonderful book?
Okay. Two of the particular areas that I've been interested in my study of history have been the development of social movements in American history, for instance, during the 1930s, the Depression era, the 1960s, and so on. And another area that I've been interested in has been the more recent history of globalization and the effects of the global economic changes on the American people. And when I was looking about for a topic for my dissertation study, I read a book by Jefferson Cowie called Capital Moves, and it's this study of the RCA Corporation and how it began the process of moving production of its consumer electronics from one place to another in order to get cheaper labor, essentially, to oversimplify. And he uses this book to point out that a lot of what we think about in today's world of companies moving to Mexico or China to get cheap labor, that this actually had a much longer history and began in, of all places, Camden, New Jersey, in his case, with the RCA Corporation. It moved from Camden to Bloomington, Indiana, eventually to Juarez, Mexico. I, having lived in this area, was aware of the other large Camden famous company in addition to RCA was Campbell Soup Company across the street from RCA. But it had a very different history. It did not run away. It opened up there in 1869, and it didn't implode its plant until 1991. So for about 120 years or so, it produced soup in Camden, and it somehow had to come up with ways of dealing with the same issues that RCA dealt with by moving to other places. And so I thought that would be a fascinating question to explore. So I began looking at Campbell's history to see how they were able to continue producing their soups at a very low cost over the years, and despite efforts at unionization among its employees and other impacts on their cost structure, they were able to continue producing soup and continue returning a very generous profit to the owners of the company. Mm-hmm. As I got into the study of the company, I not only found a lot of information that dealt with those issues, but I found many other things that I was not expecting to find, things about the origins of the Puerto Rican communities in Philadelphia and Camden and how they were tied to Campbell Soup's labor market policies during World War II, the connections to the McCarthy era, the very first conviction under the anti-communist provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act, were a union leader at Campbell's in Camden, and many other things too. So I was hooked by what I thought would be a somewhat interesting topic, but then I really found the story fascinating. And I interviewed many former employees, workers, union activists, company managers, engineers, And that really brought it alive to me as well. So then, with some revision, I was able to turn that into a book that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this: is Campbell Soup still headquartered in Camden? Do they still have offices there?
Yes, the corporate headquarters are still in Camden. Mm-hmm. It is one of the very few companies that is still in Camden. Now the factories are no longer there. They're spread across the country and somewhat outside the country. But the corporate headquarters are still there. Because it is the corporate headquarters and not the production facilities, unfortunately, the company doesn't provide many jobs for residents of Camden today, mm-hmm. but it is a large employer in the general South Jersey and Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm. I see. I was asking because I wondered where the archives are for the Campbell Soup Company and whether they were open about letting you in them or look at them, that kind of thing.
Well, the Campbell Soup does have archives at its headquarters in Camden, and they were happy to let me look at them. Though, as you might expect, a company that is still very much still in business, what is in their archives is not unexpectedly somewhat limited. They do have a lot of material relating to marketing, in which Campbell's has been responsible for many innovations, but my focus was not especially on marketing, so I, in fact, didn't find a whole lot of material that was directly relevant to what I was looking at there. So mm-hmm. I actually did most of my research in other archives.
I see. So why don't we begin the story of Campbell's Soup with I guess, canned goods. You talk a little bit about the origins of canned goods, but why don't you explain to us exactly where they come from?
Okay, well, the preservation of food has been a very important component of the development of global capitalism, and there are many things that could not have been done if prepared foods, preserved foods were not available. The actual origin of canning itself came from Napoleon Bonaparte, who had a competition for someone who could develop a method of preserving food for his troops, and the winner of that competition was one Nicolas Appert, and he developed the initial methods of canning food, and the rest is history, mm-hmm. essentially. In the United States, the Civil War created a great demand for canned foods, preserved foods, and that there were many small canning companies that sprung up during that period, and Campbell's in particular, as well as H.J. Heinz, were both founded in 1869. Mm-hmm. Campbell's was the result of a collaboration between a tinsmith, Abraham Anderson, and a produce wholesaler, Joseph Campbell. And they began that company, one of a large number of companies involved in canning in South Jersey. South Jersey was especially suited for this new industry for a few reasons, and one of them, probably the most important, was that the South Jersey agricultural area produced what became known as the premier tomato for canning purposes, and so the Jersey tomato became the real basis of the canning industry and of Campbell's, well, Joseph Campbell Preserve Company, as it was originally called, and later Campbell's Soup Company. Mm-hmm. And in addition to the close ties to the agricultural produce of the region, the location of Camden, right across the river from Philadelphia, centrally located in the Mid-Atlantic states, was also an excellent distribution point for the finished product.
Mm-hmm. When did Campbell's? I'm trying to think of other canned soup brands, and the only one I can think of is Progresso, but I'm sure there are others. When did Campbell's Soup become kind of the national brand in? Or let me put it differently. When did Campbell's Soup become a large, a kind of quasi-national brand?
Well, there were many small companies involved in canning and several in soups, but soup production was a pretty minimal part even of the canning industry through the 1890s. One of the problems with canning soup was that soup is mostly water, and so when you made soup, you had to fill cans with the ingredients that included a large amount of water. It was a heavy product to ship. It was very bulky. And so the cost that had to be charged for soup was more than most people were willing to spend, and so it never really caught on. Mm-hmm. A few different companies began experimenting with removing the water from soup, condensing soup or concentrating soup. Campbell actually is the company that's generally credited with inventing condensed soup, although I found that a number of other companies in the 1890s were also producing something that they were calling concentrated soup. But in any case, one of the families that had gotten involved with the Campbell Company in the 1890s were the Dorrance family, which is a wealthy family originally from Bristol, Pennsylvania. And one of the young members of the Dorrance family that joined the company in 1897 was a chemist who had just gotten his PhD from the University of Göttingen in Germany. And when he returned to the United States, rather than teaching at Cornell or Bryn Mawr, where he was offered positions, he decided to join his uncle at the Campbell Soup Company in Camden. And he opened up the laboratory there. And as the legend goes, he came up with the brilliant idea. As Fortune magazine said in 1935, the only original idea that Campbell Soup ever had. I don't know whether that's true, but the Campbell Company began producing condensed soups by removing most of the water. They were able to greatly reduce the warehousing costs, the shipment costs, and so the selling cost of a can of soup was set at 10 cents a can, and it stayed that way for decades. So Dorrance also began very actively marketing his new condensed soup. He used basically any techniques that were at the forefront of marketing. He was one of the first people there doing it. He initially started out putting placards in streetcars. He quickly started advertising in magazines, and he had very particular ideas about how things should be advertised and the location within the magazine. He studied all this very closely. As when radio came about, later when television came about, the Campbell Company was always there at the forefront, being the sponsor of the Amos and Andy show, of Lassie, and so on. So in any case, essentially what Dorrance and his company did were to create a new need in the mind of the American consumer that if a housewife wanted to feed her family nutritionally and easily, she could make Campbell soup a central part of her menu, and from there the numbers of cans of soup sold grew very rapidly from about 1900 through the late 1920s, and by the late 1920s, Campbell was producing about 10 million cans a day during the tomato season, a 1 to 2 month period every summer. Mm-hmm. And tomato soup remained the real essence of the company, but they expanded into many other lines of soup as well.
Mm-hmm. So John Dorrance, as you've mentioned, plays a central role in the story of Campbell Soup and the people who work there, and I suppose all of American culture. Could you talk a little bit about his role? He was quite the rationalizer, I think we would say.
Yeah, very much so. As I mentioned a little bit about his attention to even what page in a magazine the Campbell's advertisements would be on. Well, that was at the end point, at the marketing and distribution point. But his interest in being a rationalizer and then being a real micromanager went all the way back to the beginning of the production of soup, and that is in growing the tomato plants and the other plants that would be used to grow the ingredients that went into the soup. The Campbell Company began providing seeds and small plants to farmers that it contracted with Its contracts were extremely specific, and what the farmers must do to grow the tomatoes and other produce, how much and which types of fertilizer and insecticide to use. These farms were visited by Campbell inspectors to make sure they were following the letter of the law and following through on their agreements, and they were required to sell all of their produce to the Campbell Company. But most of all, and really the primary subject of my book, was in the production of soup itself, that John T. Dorrance put most of his effort in deciding how every person in the plant, up to 5,000 or 6,000 people in its heyday, year-round, in addition to about double that number in the summer during the tomato season. He had his managers develop various procedures that were collected in a procedures book, and every single job in the plant was what the responsibilities of the employees that carried out those operations. They were detailed down to the minute. John Dorrance was an early advocate of scientific management. Frederick Taylor had pioneered scientific management across the river in Philadelphia. Dorrance didn't adopt a method of scientific management that was close to Taylor's original ideas, but instead he went with an alternative that promised a much quicker return, and this was known as the Bideau system. The Bideau was someone who was really more of a salesman. He was called a charlatan by some critics, and he took some of the essential ideas of Taylor in scientific management, and he would knock on the doors of CEOs in the teens and 20s, promising them that they would see a rapid return, a very quick return on their investment, and that their plants would become much more efficient. And Dorrance allowed Charles Bideau to come in and do a test run in some departments, and Dorrance was convinced that this would help him continue to make his soup and other products in a more efficient manner, and it really fit in with his ideas. His procedures book already existed, and a lot of what Bideau had companies do, Dorrance had really already done, so this allowed him to come up with even further levels of detail in assigning to each job what he called a B rating, the letter B after Bideau, and the B ratings that employees would be required to produce 60 bees per hour if they wanted to continue to hold their job. And if they produced in excess of 60 bees per hour, then they were given a bonus in some proportion to the excess above 60. Dorrance, these are just a couple of the examples of the ways that he really looked at how everything in the production of soup could be done more and more efficiently. He was a great advocate of automation. The production of soup allowed automation in some areas, and he aggressively pursued those kinds of efforts at automation, but many other areas were very difficult to automate, things such as eviscerating chickens in the preparation of things like potatoes. There were potatoes that had not only to be skinned, but some of them had more blemishes in them than others that had to be cut out. There were so many areas that prevented automation that what his plants turned out to be was an amalgam of some highly automated parts and other parts in which the human workers were integrated into the great machine that was the Campbell soup.
I'm glad to hear that metaphor, because for anyone who's ever made something like chicken noodle soup, that is from scratch, or tomato soup, it's hard to imagine how you could automate it. How exactly was chicken noodle soup or tomato soup made? How did he make a factory, a system of discrete procedures that started with, let's say, tomatoes and ended up with that stuff in a can with a label on it?
Okay. Well, the structure of the plant in Camden and the second location for Campbell was in Chicago in 1929. A plant was built there, and the structure of both of these plants was very similar. They were six-story plants. The design involved the movement of the ingredients to the top floor. In my book, there's a picture of a conveyor belt that's carrying tomatoes to the top floor of the plant. On the top floor, you had the people that worked in preparation, and preparation involved inspection. It involved whatever other processes need to be done to, as I mentioned, paring potatoes or cutting onions or the various kinds of things like that. And that was generally done on the top floor by primarily women who were involved in food preparation. A lot of the employment makeup of the soup companies took a lot of the concepts about the proper role of women, what women could do, and it was assumed that they could almost naturally do things like food preparation, because that's one of the things that they were doing in their homes. And so the food preparation tasks were overwhelmingly given to women, and they worked at various tables on the top floor doing the various initial preparation tasks. The next step, what happened is gravity was essentially used to, as each stage in the production process was completed, gravity was used to bring that stage of the product down to the next floor, and the various processes can be considered to be in one of three stages, and the first being preparation, the second being blending, and then the third being the final processing and cooking and canning. And the blending was done on the middle floor, in which for a long time men with large oars stirred the soup in large cauldrons until the right blend was gotten. The different ingredients and seasonings were added at this intermediate stage. And then the final stage on the lower floors involved the placement of the soup in cans, the sealing of the cans, and then the cans being moved to large cookers, or retorts, as they called them, in which the filled soup cans were raised to a certain temperature for a certain amount of time to cook them. Then when they came out of the retorts, then they went through labeling machines and workers running labeling machines with labels on them. And then finally on the ground floor, the cans were put into cases and loaded onto trucks and railroad cars for shipment around the country.
I think at one point in the book you described the entire thing as a giant grist mill. So the ingredients go in the top, and the stuff comes out the bottom.
Right. That's a good shorthand description.
Yeah, that's a brilliant metaphor. I'd never really realized it was done like that, but that's exactly what it is. So after the company reached its full and modern size, describe who worked there and what the working conditions were like.
Well, Campbell's because of Dorrance's commitment to keeping the soup available at a low price, as I mentioned, 10 cents a can for a long time, there were increases in costs for ingredients, for shipping, and other areas. And so he had to cut the costs wherever he could. And so in the production process, this is where he did this, whether by automation or by employing a workforce that would accept fairly low pay. And so until the 1930s in particular, Campbell's was known as a company that did not pay a lot of money. And so a lot of the people that worked there were not many of the working class people that lived in the Camden or Philadelphia areas for a long time, but were more recent immigrants. And in particular, in the early years, there were many Italian immigrants and children of Italian immigrants that filled most of the production jobs throughout the company, from the women that worked in preparation through the men that worked in the blending, and men and women that worked in the final processing steps. The company also hired some African-American men to do certain laboring jobs, as well as jobs such as janitors and so on. Blacks had very limited opportunities until the 1940s in Campbell. No black women were hired, and only black men were for a very limited range of job options. Throughout the years, Campbell changed the particular source of its employees as things changed, the demographics changed in the area. During World War II, Campbell faced a real problem because while it still felt this need to pay its workers at fairly minimal levels, there was a real labor shortage during World War II. Not only were people going to the front, they were also going into filling other factories where they were paid better. As well, Campbell's demands for food production during the war increased tremendously. So at that point, Campbell searched around for other areas of potential labor, and it partnered with the War Manpower Commission of the U.S. government to bring in many migrant workers from Puerto Rico. Contracted with workers in Florida that worked in citrus much of the year, African American workers that brought them up for the peak season in the summer. It brought workers in from the Caribbean, the English speaking Caribbean, and other areas. And the end of the war approached, it even began considering the use of German prisoners of war, although it did not actually use prisoners of war. So over the years, the source of the people that came to work at Campbell's has changed, but it always were groups that were generally not at the center of or groups that did not have a long experience with working in factories in industrial areas, but were generally the newcomers, and many different groups used their experience at Campbell's as an entry into the industrial workforce, mm-hmm. and many did move on to working in other places in later years.
Mm-hmm. I see. So one of the things that stood out for me in the book was the explicit use of differential treatment and pay for different classes of workers. This was company policy for decades. Can you describe that?
Yes. The company really invested heavily in the segmentation of its workforce along many different categories. The men and women were, of course, one of the ways that it differentiated. Women were paid far less than men, even in cases where they did the exact same work. In most cases, women did different work than men did, but there were a few job definitions in which both men and women worked, but women were paid significantly less than that. Even among men, Campbell differentiated between men and what are called boys. Boys were male workers up to the age of 21, who often or usually did, again, the same work that men over the age of 21 did, but they were classified as boys and paid usually a couple cents above per hour above what women were working, but far less than the average pay for men. One other large area of differentiation, segmentation within the workforce was between permanent and temporary workers. As I said, at its peak, Campbell employed about 5,000 people year-round, but about 10,000 during tomato season. Those additional 5,000 temporary workers were marked as different and really inferior. Their employee ID badges had a large black T on them, so they could be easily identified, and they were also paid less. Again, if they were doing the same job as other permanent employees, they still were paid at less as temporaries. This kind of segmentation eventually began to fall by the wayside by the 1950s and 1960s, especially under the pressure of their union and by the 1960s by civil rights laws. But by that point, the company began to switch towards segmentation instead by geographical region. Mm-hmm. In the early years, Campbell was only in Camden for a long time and then in Chicago, too. But by the 60s, it had opened up additional plants in Sacramento, California, and Napoleon, Ohio, and Paris, Texas. And the company began playing one plant off against another, so that if during contract negotiation time one of the plants went on strike, the company would simply ramp up production at another plant in another location and wait out the strike until the workers went back essentially for what the company had initially offered. So this kind of segmentation shifted in an interesting way from one being primarily along gender and racial and ethnic lines and age lines to one based more on regional location. And but it's been a longstanding part of working at Campbell for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned unions, because unions play a very important part in your book and in the story of Campbell Soup. So alongside the principle of segmentation, another principle of Dorrance and the Campbell management was a kind of ferocious anti-unionism. I want to ask about the origins of that and also how eventually the union made its way into the Campbell Soup factory in Camden.
Okay, well, as you might expect, someone with the extraordinary attention to control that John T. Dorrance had was certainly not prepared to share the control of the plant with any other person or organization. And the thought that there would be a union that he and his management would need to negotiate with in deciding things like working rules and even pay was something that was really anathema to his whole philosophy of running a business. And through the early 1930s, there had been no real unionization at all of any of the employees at Campbell Soup. And in fact, in Camden as a whole, there were many large industrial plants in Camden by the 1930s, but virtually none of them were unionized. There were some smaller craft unions that had existed since the 19th century and for various small crafts such as plumbers and so on, but the RCA's, New York Ship, Campbell Soup and other companies had no. These were companies that were operating on the newer large large industrial model that, that characterized the Fordist period of American industrial capitalism. And until the 1930s, there were no unions. By 1933, 1934, most of these companies, the employees at these companies, began to try to change the conditions of their work. And this is part of the much larger story of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, that, that grew up in the 1930s. And Camden really became the real hotbed of CIO organization. All the companies that I mentioned became the locations of very active and radical locals of a number of unions that were affiliated with the CIO. In the case of Campbell's, initially in 1934, there was a very spontaneous rank-and-file uprising almost, that the people were fed up, and 2,000 people essentially walked out and tried to get the company to recognize the union. The company essentially refused to deal with the union. As I said, Dorrance was not at all willing to concede anything to sharing control, and that early effort was defeated. By the late 1930s, a more experienced and a more radical committed group of activists within the soup plant began another organizing drive, and this was essentially, the drive was essentially led by two groups within Campbell's. One was was the men of the maintenance group. The maintenance group were the mechanics that fixed machines when they broke and constructed new machines and so on. And they were men who held some skills that Campbell could not do without. And so they felt that they should be getting paid much better than they were. And they had the skills that Campbell was really dependent on and could not easily fire, because they couldn't just hire anyone off the street to fill those jobs. So that was one group that was strongly behind the immunization campaign. Another group were leftist activists, who many of whom had participated as very young people in the 1934 abortive strike. One of them was John Tisa, who was a high school student. His mother was an Italian immigrant who worked at Campbell's all her life on the chicken preparation line. And John Tisa worked there at the peak season in the summer when he was in high school. He had participated in the 1934 strike, and became radicalized through his participation in that. And he became known as the class socialist in Camden High School. Later went to an AFL, American Federation of Labor convention, where he heard about the battle in Spain against the fascists. And after hearing this and being inspired by the stories he heard, he rushed off to join the Abraham Lincoln Brigade as an American volunteer in the fight against fascism in the late 1930s. So off he went to Spain. And in fact, after the defeat of the loyalist cause in Spain, he was actually the last American to leave alive from Spain.
Really?
Yes. And he came back to Camden, and by this time he had joined the Communist Party, and from being a somewhat more amorphous kind of socialist or radical in his high school days, he was now a committed communist. His mother still worked at the plant. He had many other friends, like Tony Valentino, who was working at the plant this whole time, who was also quickly moved left and joined the Communist Party. There were many others who were active in the Socialist Party and some independent radicals and so on. So you had the first group of maintenance workers, the second group of people from the neighborhood who had become radicalized, and between the two of them, they built a movement that eventually attracted the support of the overwhelming majority of Campbell employees. And one of the other advantages they had by 1939, 1940, compared to the 1934 strike, was that the labor laws in the U.S. were much stronger by then. In 1935, the Wagner Act made it much easier for unions, once they won an election showing that the majority of the employees wanted to affiliate with the union, it made it much easier for a union to gain recognition in that way than it was before 1935. So using the Wagner Act and using this movement that was built up over a number of years, they created a what became known as Local 80, and which had a long and very interesting career at Campbell's. The Local 80 was associated initially with the United Cannery Workers, which was probably the most diverse union in the United States. It was a fascinating union that organized many downtrodden groups that other unions just didn't bother organizing. It organized tobacco workers in the South, black and white tobacco workers. It organized oyster shuckers, cemetery diggers, all these groups that were not considered any central part of the economy, but the United Cannery Workers, or UCAPWA, as their long official name abbreviates to, UCAPWA was what historian Vicki Ruiz called, she called it a women's union because of the high level of activity, participation and leadership by many women, and it was diverse and in all sorts of ways in organizing many people across the country. Mm-hmm. UCAPWA changed its name to the Food and Tobacco Workers in the 1940s because it did include a large number of tobacco workers in addition to cannery workers and other workers. But by the late 1940s, beginnings of McCarthyism and a lot of anti-communist hysteria in various segments of American society also hit the union movement. And within the CIO, there was essentially a split between the left-led unions and several other unions that were opposed to the leftist leadership of those unions, and about 10 or 12 unions either left or were expelled from the CIO in 1950, and one of those was the Food and Tobacco Workers. Mm. Local 80, what happened with many of the locals that were part of the Food and Tobacco Workers at that time, they essentially went out of business and did not exist after that point. Local 80 in Camden, at that point, disaffiliated from the remnants of the Food and Tobacco Workers, stayed independent for a year, and then reaffiliated with probably the one most progressive left-leaning union that was still in the CIO, and that was the United Packing House Workers that had organized many of the Chicago and Midwestern slaughterhouses and packing houses. And so from 1951 through 1968, Local 80 was affiliated with the packing house workers. By 1968, the packing house workers itself, because of changes in the meatpacking industry, had shrunk and became part of the Amalgamated Meat Cutters. So Local 80 then became an Amalgamated Meat Cutters local. And then in the next decade, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters itself merged into the Food and Tobacco Workers. So Local 80 was always the local at Camden, but over the years from 1940 through 1990, when the plant closed, it went through several changes in the national union that it was affiliated with.
Mm-hmm, I see. I'm going to ask what I think will probably sound like to many people a silly question, but did Campbell's, did the management ever see the light on unions? Did they ever find a way to really effectively deal with them other than try to break them?
Well, for most of the history of Local 80, the management had a pretty antagonistic attitude towards towards the Union and used a number of different strategies over the years to try to defeat the unions and the support that they had among the employees. By the 1970s, as I mentioned, when the packing house workers went out of business and merged into the Amalgamated Meat Cutters, that union was a lot more conservative. It had been an old craft-based union, one of the old AFL unions going back to the 19th century. And its history, while it had a record of a few militant strikes, for the most part, it had a much more conciliatory relationship with management than some of these other unions that I mentioned. So by the 1970s and with the driving out from local 80 of some of the most radical leadership during the McCarthy era, the remaining local 80 leaders and especially the national union that it was affiliated with on the union side became more conciliatory towards Campbell's. And so by the 1970s, Campbell in return did really change its policy towards unions. It decided to accept what it considered a responsible union, and agreed during the remaining decade or so of its existence in Camden to give fairly decent raises to the employees at contract time, but in return it expected the union to not try to tell it how to run its business, and things like the introduction of automation that led to the loss of many jobs. The union was to have no say in that. It was just to go along with what company decisions made. So it was a sort of a bargain that in the early years the two fought each other, you might consider more or less as equals, that they both had strong bases of power. By the 1970s, when the union had been weakened, and the company was in a stronger position, it essentially imposed its conditions, and the union accepted that, and then the company was able to deal in a way, in a different way with unions that allowed labor peace to exist for, as I said, the last decade or so of its existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is one of the great, I don't know if the right word is irony or not, but at the moment at which management comes to see the unions in a kind of favorable light and work with them, just 10 years later, the game is pretty much up. And Campbell's leaves Camden, at least leaves the production facilities. Why did that happen?
Well, one of the things that I've been looking at since the book is an interesting thing that I noticed throughout the course of Campbell's history, and that was the interesting connection of food processing companies in general, and including Campbell's, the relationship of these companies to the rhythms and the restraints of nature. And as I mentioned, South Jersey had been considered the best place to produce tomatoes for canning. So since the tomatoes had to be processed immediately upon harvesting, the soup plants and canning plants had to be located right in their midst or right directly adjacent to those locations. And so for a long time, Campbell was really tied to its location in South Jersey by its dependence on its raw materials, its most essential raw material, as well as the other agricultural inputs. Now, by the 1960s and 1970s, there was a major change in how tomatoes were harvested. In particular, now, the harvesting of the tomatoes was a very large part of the cost, and through government aid at the University of California, the tomato harvester was developed that was a machine that would go through tomato fields and harvest all the tomatoes at once. But this had certain requirements of its own, that you had to have an area that had very dependable weather, predictable weather. It had to have very large areas. It had to have a type of tomato that could withstand being harvested by a machine, as well as tomatoes that all ripened at the same time, because this machine would just make a single pass, as opposed to the old hand-pick methods in which farm workers would go through the fields multiple times to pick the ripe tomatoes by hand. By the early 1970s and the development of the tomato harvester in California, it finally became possible for companies that were using tomatoes as an input to locate their final processing plants wherever they wanted, and they only needed to locate the initial stage in which tomatoes were turned into tomato paste. And then the tomato paste was used as input for everything else. Mm-hmm. So by the 1970s, in fact, by 1979, Campbell announced that it was no longer going to use the famous Jersey tomato. Now, being from this area, I can tell you that came as quite a bit of a shock to people, that Campbell would not be using the Jersey tomato, which everyone around here is very proud of, and can't imagine that the tomatoes anywhere else could taste anywhere near as good. But Campbell, by that point, was trucking in large volumes of tomato paste that were stored in drums or large boxes from California, actually. So by the 1970s and 1980s, the production of processing tomatoes as opposed to fresh tomatoes, the processing tomatoes were almost 100% now being produced in California, turned into paste at very special tomato paste processing plants, and then shipped from there to places like Camden or places like Napoleon, Ohio, which was another plant which had been located there because it was in the middle of the Ohio tomato growing region. But by this point, that necessity, that restraint of nature, was broken, and not only did that affect where the location of plants could be, it also broke down the old dependence of companies like Campbell on having a large seasonal workforce during the tomato season. No longer did it have to scurry to find an additional 5,000 workers in August and September during the tomato season, but now, because it was using paste, it could spread the production of tomato soup and other products throughout the year. So it was essentially this overcoming the restraints of nature by the 1970s that allowed Campbell to no longer be tied to South Jersey. By that point, had begun building some really ultra-modern plants. It built what really was the final death knell for Camden. The company brought online an ultra-modern plant in Maxton, in North Carolina. And this plant was built on a very different model than the original grist mill structure of the Camden and Chicago plants. The Maxton plant actually turned out to be far more efficient and is much more similar to virtually all industrial plants that are built today. And in this plant, all the processing is done on one floor. The raw ingredients are brought in on one side of the plant, and then the different stages proceed across the floor until you get to the other end, mm-hmm. when the final product goes out the other door. Mm-hmm. What had happened over the years is, especially as a lot of these old buildings in Camden and Chicago became old and a bit decrepit, and a lot of the elevators and other mechanisms for moving things around the plants broke down, that turned out to become a great inefficiency. And so what had been seen as a very modern and enlightened manner of designing a factory turned out after a century to be not such a great design, especially when the buildings themselves were so old. Mm-hmm. So by the 1980s, Campbell's did not need to be tied to this location, and it had built newer plants elsewhere, in particular this new plant in Maxton. And so in 1989, the company announced that it would be closing Camden the following year, and then in 1991, it had an implosion that demolished the entire factory mm-hmm. in 3 or 4 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, before we go, we've taken up a lot of your time, two very quick questions, and I really want to hear the answers to these, though. The first is, how is Campbell's doing today? And the second is, how is Camden doing today?
Well, one is doing very well, and one is doing very poorly. And then you might guess mm-hmm. which is which. Campbell Soup is doing very well. The Darnes family has continued to benefit from the wealth created by the great-grandfather, the patriarch of the family. The recent list of billionaires that just came out from Forbes magazine includes a number of descendants of Darnes. Mm-hmm. And the company itself is doing well. It's had its ups and downs, and its stock price will vary depending on which day you look at it. But overall, it is doing well. The city of Camden, unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, RCA had moved out most of its production facilities a long time ago, and the many other industries that had made Camden the most industrialized city in New Jersey had left over the years, and Campbell was really the last one. That was the final nail in the coffin when Campbell did move out and remove those last 1,000 production jobs. There were really just about no place to work in Camden for Camden's residents. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are a few bright spots, but the remaining employers, things such as Rutgers University in Camden, Cooper Hospital, the Campbell corporate headquarters, most of them employ suburbanites, mm-hmm. and in the case of the first two, they also are nonprofits, so they don't contribute to the tax base, and so the Camden has, despite some valiant efforts by various groups of residents to try to regain control and change the direction of the city, results so far have not been very bright.
Well, I hope that things turn up for Camden. I want to thank you for writing the book and for spending the time to talk with us about it today. It's a fascinating book. We've been talking to Dan Sidorek about his book, Condensed Capitalism, Campbell Soup and the Pursuit of Cheap Production in the 20th Century. Dan, I'm going to close the interview with our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, after the book, as I mentioned, the topic of the connection of food processing industries to the rhythms and restraints of nature were something that I did look at and I presented a couple papers on. Now I'm in the early exploratory stages of a couple other new areas, but I'm not ready. I'm not at the point where I can really say anything intelligent about those, so I'll leave it at that right now.
That's refreshing, actually. Usually people have sort of a full-blown plan. I have about 1,000 of them, and none of them
right.
ever really
kind of... if I was committed to one of these, I would do that. But
don't say a thing. I give you kudos for that. Yeah, that restraint. But anyway, Dan, thanks very much for talking to us today.
Well, thanks very much, Marshall. I enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Dan Sidorek about his book, Condensed Capitalism, Campbell Soup, and the Pursuit of Cheap Production in the 20th Century. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.